welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. The cultures of consciousness are our smorgasbord. You know, one of the most interesting things about psychedelics, in my opinion, is psychedelic literature about psychedelics, which is kind of a funny thing to say, because a lot of people think about, if they don't demonize psychedelics, they think, you know, it's all about the experience. You know, here's finally an opportunity for you to have your own experience, and it's about what happens in this extraordinary states of consciousness and all the things that arise from that, which is true enough. But I also think it's produced a really incredible and very interesting kind of literature. It's a weird zone because it's illegal or has been scheduled for so long in our contemporary modern context. It has a marginal countercultural quality, even if a lot of work people doing it is totally above board stuff. But it's also interesting because it forces people to weave together very different kinds of thinking. You know, it's a very, very interdisciplinary field because not that every author is touching all these elements, but if you think about it, any really adequate account of psychedelics in human history, in human experience, has to involve history, pharmacology, ethnobotany, anthropology, religion, literature, you know, media. It goes on and on. Law. It's one of these cross-genre topics. And particularly interesting for me as a sort of student of contemporary religious forms and spiritual practices is the way in which these other kinds of ways of looking at the world, history, pharmacology, science, chemistry, interface with the sort of spiritual questions that are raised for so many people about the topic of psychedelics. And a couple of years ago for the Arrowhead Extracts, which is a wonderful publication that you get if you become a member of the Arrowhead Foundation or the Arrowhead team, which if you're listening to the show, you probably should think about anyway. But anyways, you get a copy of Extracts, and I did a roundup on my favorite books about psychedelics and gnosis. And so I wrote about Aleister Crowley's, or the collections of Crowley's writing and other writings in the Regardi volume, Rolling Away the Stone, which includes Crowley's remarkable essays on hashish. Hashish played a very important role in his most mystical thinkings about the nature of the highest levels of spiritual attainment, less the magical stuff that people often think of him. I mean, of course, it's linked, but very Gnostic, very metaphysical writing. And I wrote about Dale Pendle, who we've had on the show, and of course his remarkable pharmacognosis series. And the other book I wrote was by a fellow named Jim DeCorn, who is our guest today on Expanding Mind, and I wrote about his book, Psychedelic Shamanism, which really blew my mind when I first got my hands on it in the early 90s, which is, I believe, when it first came out. Jim was a stalwart member of the entheogenic underground as a writer, editor, thinker. And what I really loved about psychedelic shamanism is that, along with including a lot of information that has been actually updated in a recent volume, because some of it was out of date, is that Jim offered a really penetrating and provocative way of thinking about the nature of entities, the larger spiritual context within which psychedelics can and sometimes can't always so well operate. And it was just a very refreshing book that was at once down to earth and very, very esoteric and inspiring. So I'm very glad that Jim came out with a new book, another book, I think came out last year, called The Cracking Tower, which another one of my Arrowhead friends, the great David Arnson, recommended to me, and it similarly blew my mind. So we'll be talking about that with Jim. But first we'll bring on our co-host here, on Expanding Mind. Masha Dawood. Masha, how you doing?
I'm good, Eric. What's up?
Did you get over your migraine?
I did, yeah. I had one yesterday talking about a cracking tower, man.
Have you ever been on the show when you had a migraine?
Not when I had a migraine, no. I get pretty obliterated. Like, it hits my eyeballs. It's all eyeball style and visual stuff. And then I have trouble talking, so it's pretty gnarly.
You'd have to just take a rate check. But do you at least get some, do you get any kind of interesting hallucinations or anything?
Oh, yeah, the visual stuff. It's like static on TV.
Like everywhere, or does it cluster around objects?
It kind of starts peripheral, and then it starts to invade the middle. It's pretty interesting. Like, I've kind of tracked it just when I get, like, the pain's really bad. You can just kind of watch it like you're watching TV.
Yeah.
And it does. It gets pretty trippy.
Yeah, that's an intense experience. I mean, there's nothing like pain in your head. I mean, I've only had a couple of really terrible headaches that I don't even think count as migraines, but I, when I was younger, especially used to have earaches. It's the same kind of thing where you have this, like, intense knife-like pain, like, somewhere behind your eyeball, right next to your subjectivity, you know? It's a whole practice in itself just to work with that. It's crazy.
Yes, it is. I do a lot of pressure points for it, and I took a whole bunch of herbs, and then I burned a bunch of moxa on me, so then I felt better.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you're back with us today.
Thanks.
So let's say hi to Jim DeCorn. Jim, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Okay, thank you.
And are you on the Big Island? You're in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, I'm in Hilo, Hawaii.
Lucky you, man.
Well, it's been raining, but right now it's sunny.
Yeah, but with the rain,
this is
all that lush.
The west side of the island. It's the windward side. We get a lot of rain here. But
yeah,
I like it. I used to live in New Mexico where it was too dry, so now it's too wet. And I guess I'll try to find a middle ground somewhere.
I love the Hilo side. So anyway, thanks for joining us. And, you know, again, I really have enjoyed both your books a great deal. And even though, you know, you have a lot to say about things that aren't just about psychedelics, really about larger spiritual, psycho-spiritual, cultural commentary, you know, what sort of this, you know, you're a very much a case of somebody who had some very profound experiences that led you in all sorts of ways, including ones that you know, didn't involve psychoactives anymore. But because that was such an important part in your own story, you know, as a younger person, I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit on some of the core experiences. I know in both your books, you tell some really remarkable tales, but even without going into, you know, tons of detail, just a little bit about how those experiences when you were a younger person really set you off on your life course.
Yeah. Okay. I can say unequivocally that my life is utterly different than what it would have been if I had not had, well, my first experience was an LSD experience in which at the time I didn't quite know any of the terminology because I hadn't studied any of the stuff, but it was basically afterwards in reading all of the literature and everything, I was in a state of samadhi for about, 4 or 5 hours. And it was a state in which everything was perfectly united. There was no good, there was no evil. Everything was just beautiful and wonderful and just exactly the way it should be all by itself. There was, you know, it was a state of ultimate perfection, and it was like anybody who's ever had such an experience, they would do anything to attain that permanently. And what was amazing to me was that how close it was. Even while I was experiencing it, I could see, understand that it was not that different from normal consciousness. It's just
right.
One little level removed away, and you know, you're an enlightenment, basically. And my life changed utterly after that. Psychedelics, so that to that point, I can say the psychedelic experience altered my life completely, and it's never been the same, and it could never go back to the way it was before. By the same token, I got into the thing where after I had a few more experiences, I started seeing that the experience itself, for me personally, I reached a limit where it was like, after a while, it would be like, well, been there, done that, I've seen that already. What else is there to see? And I finally got to the point where I realized that to continuously focus on the substance itself, acid or mushrooms or DMT or whatever, you know, you happen to be using, isn't really the point. It's more like, you know, like Columbus discovers the New World, and then everybody talks about the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, the vessels that got them there, and they're not paying attention to, hey, this is a new world. What's here? You know, it's that kind of thing.
So yeah, that was Alan Watts line, you know, when you get the message, you can hang up the phone.
Yeah, but the message is very important, and it's very essential. And so I'm not anti-psychedelic at all, but I am probably a little more conservative about it than a lot of people, contemporaries, are, you know.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that's a really important point in that Alan Watts line, you know, once you get the message, you can hang up, because there's this thing that happens to a lot of people once they have that experience you were talking about, reach that samadhi. Like you said, they'll try and do anything to, like, keep it going or get back to that place. And, I mean, some of them become very destructive, right? Some of them reach that place, and it's like life becomes terrible because nothing can kind of get to that, and then they become, you know, kind of drug addicts or whatever. But then there's other people that go the other end, which it seems like maybe if you're a little more conservative, you can kind of get that and then integrate it. What do you think is the difference between, like, how people take it, like, to such extremes? It either kind of spirals them down, or they kick up into, like, a mega spiritual experience with it.
Well, you know, we're all subjective observers. Nobody can perceive objectively, so everything is filtered through who we are, our personality and everything. So I can only speak for myself, but one of the things is, my first trip was samadhi. My second trip was, if you can imagine, the exact opposite of what that might be. Mm. It was pure hell. Mm. It was totally fragmented, torn apart. It was one of the most horrible experiences I've ever had in my life. So the first experience was unification and oneness, and the second experience with utter fragmentation, and everything was torn apart. It was
I just want to interrupt just for a second, just because this was, again, one of the wonderful things about when you tell those two stories, especially in the psychedelic shamanism, where you really just lay out, like, a number of your kind of peak experiences over your life. And so you get this first description of just a classic, you know, LSD unity samadhi story. I mean, it's like, they're wonderful, but it's like, frankly, I've read them before, or I have my own, you know, idea of that state. But it was like, that's like this one. And then you immediately followed up not with, like, more rapturous accounts of the further planes of, you know, of Buddha light, but instead this kind of, you know, it's like a Tibetan Book of the Dead in, California, you know, mid-60s, where you go to a car show and there's, like, all the, like, creatures and sort of Mad Magazine designs on the cars are, like, becoming these monsters, and you're going, and your friends are barely holding. It was such a, there was something beautiful about the juxtaposition of those worlds. As well as, you know, as opposed to just talking about the samadhi part, where it really, you know, opens up the whole the shamanic realm, because that's part of what the shamanic realm is about, is wrestling with those the bardo realms.
Yeah, and as I point out in psychedelic shamanism, and I talk about it also in the Cracking Tower. The Cracking Tower is actually the sequel to psychedelic shamanism. It sort of shows where my thought had gone. Actually, psychedelic shamanism came out, 18 years ago? I revised it. It came out, last year, a revised edition. I took out some incorrect stuff, and I added some you know, new things. But basically, the thing is that the unification experience and the total fragmentation experience are the poles of the whole shamanic cosmos.
Yeah.
And it's like the whole idea of unity and multiplicity. And I talk a little bit about the alchemical formula of it goes salve et coagula et abimus magisterium. What that means is take it apart, purify all the parts, and then put it back together again. And that's a formula for enlightenment. And it's I didn't know anything about any of those things at that time of my life. I only discovered it afterwards. And I now look back on those two experiences, and I realize, because of all of the work I've done since then, that I was being set up. I was being set up for this koan. Is life unification and unity, or is it just a hell world of everything torn to shreds? Well, it's both. And what's the duty of the ego is to try to unify these things, to bring them together. It's the alchemical idea, reaching the philosopher's stone, which is really unifying all your disparate parts, all of your complexes and things. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. I mean, I would say we can move from that into Jung. I mean, there's a number of different touchstones for you, the larger frameworks to work this stuff out in. One is looking at shamanism, another is alchemy, another is Gnosticism. But obviously a very important part for you, and you talk about extensively in The Cracking Tower, is Jung and the idea of individuation and kind of moving towards the self. And I really appreciated, there's a lot of people have been influenced by Jung and influenced by people have been influenced by Jung, and there's a lot of different ways of talking about Jung, especially in the sort of spiritual, new age, neo-shamanic kind of world. He had, in a lot of ways, for me, a different kind of angle on it, and part of it was that you were really thinking about what did Jung mean when he talked about the archetype of the self, that archetype that in some sense we're working towards as we go through the process of individuation, which is a way of bringing into integration our egos and the unconscious. So talk a little bit about how this sort of, the two poles of the shamanic world, how they helped you understand and move into and come to your own sense of what Jung is really talking about there.
Yeah. Okay. After I'd had these experiences back in the 60s, and then, as I lived on and had other experiences and reflected back on, what was going on? What is all this about? There's got to be some kind of way to unify, rectify all of these experiences, and I started to realize that Jung analytical psychology is actually a modern kind of version of what I talk about is the perennial philosophy, and that is, if you take all of the mystical traditions and all of the spiritual stuff, all of the shamanic cultures, primitive cultures, and everything, and you look for you look for pattern recognition. What do all of these things have in common? What can we all of these here you have a shamanic culture in Siberia, and you have another one in the Amazon, and if you look at the stories about what these shamans experience in their lives, they go into the inner world and they have these experiences, and they say, oh, well, the shaman sees jaguars and in the Amazon he sees jaguars and anacondas and stuff, and in Siberia, he sees Siberian creatures and things like that. But if you look at the pattern recognition, they're really talking about the same thing. And if you look at all these spiritual traditions, they are all really reducible to what has been called the perennial philosophy, and that is the underlying reality that constitutes the human species and consciousness. And when I realized that, when I finally saw, wow, these people are really, they're all talking about the same thing. And then I realized, in the modern world, who do we have in the modern world who sort of summarizes these things? And it was like, man, Jungian psychology has it so dried up. Jungian psychology is a Gnostic system. It's a system that, you know, is totally in harmony with the perennial philosophy, along with Hermeticism and Kabbalah and Neo-Platonism and on and on and on. They are all talking about the same reality. And once you see that, it suddenly everything falls into place, and you say, ah, yeah, okay. And the whole idea of the Jungian self, which he calls the God image inside in the psyche, and anyone who studies Jung knows what this is all about, and can't go into it here because we don't have enough time. But basically, if you start paying attention, and you don't have to take psychedelics to do this. All you have to do is just start recording your dreams and making a real powerful effort to understand them, which is not easy, and it takes time to do it. But I guarantee you this, if you try this, you will convince yourself that there is a part of your unconscious that is so far superior to you in wisdom and creativity that it is indeed a God image. It's like, it's magical. It's like, whoa, what is this? And, well, people have interpreted it as a God, or, you know, the God or a God or whatever. There's all different kinds of interpretations. Jung said, this is the self. This is who you are in your highest essence, and that the ego is really, and I sort of go, Jung didn't go as far as he could have because he was a scientist and he didn't want to get too mystical. He was already being denigrated by people for being too much of a mystic. But if you look at it, you can see that the self projects an ego, a fractal of itself. It projects a fractal of itself into a human body for a lifetime. And that lifetime is to learn and to evolve. So in other words, this is what the self, this is the technique that the self uses to evolve its consciousness. And the ego is sort of like the servant of the self. And if you read any of the Jungian literature, that, you know, and tries to conform his ego consciousness with this wiser intelligence inside, and basically what that whole process is the alchemical thing of the complexes, the archetypal complexes, of which we all have an innumerable number, have to be integrated into the self. They're all like all these little separate parts.
Well, and that's really, I think, where you're right, the Jungian system is really the best modern example of it. And you can see so many other systems in modernity that only operate to pick apart, which would be like the hell trip, right? The LSD hell trip is kind of
exactly
what permeates our culture. Everything reduces, breaks down, and instead of pattern seeking, everything goes entropy style, right? Science is always looking for, where does everything diverge? Where does it split apart? Where does this go into here? Where does that go into there? And to me, like, those ones that do, that go, like you said, that go fractal style, that go like, well, wait a minute, how does this not just break apart, but how is this coming back together? And you see that so few that will look for that, the archetypes, the archons, kind of are those points that are like, well, wait a minute, this totally broke apart, but then look, it reformed again and it came back together. So you can see the Jungian model is that perfect, like, kind of thing that uses an individual person. And to me, it goes to, it's a total example of how everything comes back together, like whether it's, you know, a molecule or electrons coming back together. And Jung, he's so smart because he uses like a person's soul and their consciousness to kind of tell that coming back together thing.
Yeah, in my opinion, Jung was one of the greatest minds of the 20th century. He was amazing, and he's not, doesn't get nearly the recognition that he deserved, because Well, I don't know. We live in a kind of a materialist reality that doesn't want to recognize these things, because if we did, we'd have to take responsibility for our actions.
Yeah.
You couldn't trash out the planet if you had a Jungian perspective, because basically what we're doing is we're destroying ourselves. We're not integrating things at all. Each of us is off on our own little complex trip of, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Instead of pulling together, we're splitting apart, which is very obvious in the world now. Anyway, political discourse, we're just fragmenting into millions and millions of different points of view. We're not coming together. In terms of the axiom, solve et coagula, we're in the solve part. It's all differentiation and not coming together at all. Unification is not what's happening. It's splitting apart is what is happening.
Well, I'm curious, for you, in terms of what, you talked about working with dreams. What are some other ways that you have found to do this work with the self? It's almost like, okay, I've gotten some glimpses of this self that I can think of as an external God, or I can think of as some potential inside my own process. And obviously, the way to get towards that is through some kind of integration of grappling with the shadow, of grappling with the unconscious, of moving outside of the ego's demand, but still keeping one foot in the ego. But how do you do that? What does that actually look like? And, psychedelics can be part of that process, but they can also get in the way of that process. And you talk eloquently about both of those. I'm curious, over, your decades of all this search, what are some concrete ways that you have found to approach and to integrate with that self?
Okay, well, I started out when I finally realized that if I kept taking LSD, that it wasn't working for me anymore. It was like, okay, that wasn't the way that it wasn't taking me where I really wanted to go. It was more like instead of me driving the vehicle was driving me, and I wasn't. It was taking me where it wanted to go, and not where I wanted to go. So I said, okay, there's got to be another way to access this reality that the psychedelics would reveal to you. Psychedelic just means mind manifesting. A psychedelic drug is a mind manifesting drug. It will show you where your head is at, and it manifests your mind. And so, okay, that's great. Now I see where my head is at. How can I integrate it without having, the vehicle driving me instead of me having more control? So, all right, I started out with the dreams. And what I used to do is, I still do it. I have a small tape recorder on the pillow next to me, and whenever I have a dream, I've trained myself. I just wake up, I speak the dream into the tape, and I fall back asleep again. And sometimes, not so much anymore, I don't have as many as I used to, but in the early days, I'd sometimes have 8-10 dreams a night. And I'd spend the whole next day just transcribing them and trying to figure out what they meant, which is not easy to do. It's often very difficult to understand what the symbolism is. And that's how I got into Jung. Jungian dream analysis really started working for me. That was how I got a handle on it.
Well, and that's one of my favorite stories, too, is how Jung, he'd have people, draw their dreams and talk about them, and then he found, their dreams were the same as these old alchemy books. And one of my favorite things ever, where you can have, some housewife chick in the middle of the city, and she's, drawing her dream, and oh my God, it's the same picture as in this 18th century book.
Oh yeah, I have the same thing. I had one, I won't go into it, but I had one a couple of nights ago that was totally archetypal. It was like, this is what's really fun. In the early days, it was before the internet, so I didn't have any way to check up on what some of these symbols might mean. Well, now I got a computer, and I can check what Google says about some of these symbols, and some of the things I never could have possibly understood what the dream meant until I went online and traced out some of these symbols, and then suddenly, wow, it all came together, and it was it's like a message from God or something,
One of those things, and this is what I started out talking about literature, is, we think that there's I mean, the way that I tend to think about these things is a slightly different, where it's like we have those experiences, but then as we read and as we interpret and as we think and as we explore and do history and compare, you know, different symbols across time, that that all creates a sort of matrix wherein those messages can take more clear form. So it's like, in my experience, it's when I've gone into like reading a lot of Jung, I started to have more Jungian dreams. And it doesn't mean that it's just my mind modeling the kind of material. It's deeper than that. But it does mean that the way that you draw attention, the way that you read the world or your dreams, your experiences, is itself part of the way that those experiences unfold, you know, into your life. And so it's never like you can just have the experience. It's like you can have the experience, but if you're going to remember anything from the experience, then that memory itself is going to be bound up with what you, how you think and what you read and how you interpret the world. And so by continuing to study, by continuing to think and explore and integrate our own worlds by moving, in my experience, by moving between all these different worlds, science, even materialism, and some of those critical thinking, that Solvay stuff can be really important on the way, as long as it doesn't completely dominate the picture. And you know, and as you're doing that, you're building this richer and richer matrix, so that when new dreams come or new messages come, those special moments, they resonate all the more. So it's wonderful to think about how the internet, among all the other things that it's doing, the Solvay as well as the Coagula, how the internet is creating itself a kind of matrix within which people find resonance for these images, these odd bits of names, details that cross their mind, and suddenly there's a space to see the richness of it.
Yeah, actually, you've just given an excellent description of what the alchemists called doing the work, doing the great work of transformation. When the ego starts doing the work, starts paying attention to these things, then the unconscious, the self, will start feeding back, and it's a conversation. It's back and forth, and as you do this, as you go through this process, your personality changes. I am so different today than who I was, you know, 33 years ago, or 40 or 50, you know, however years ago. I'm just a totally different person, and it's all because of doing the work, doing what you've just described, and having this conversation with this other part of myself. Now, Jung called it the God image. He also called it the self. I have gone on the hypothesis that this is just a higher fractal of me. This is this entity, this incredibly creative being who sends me these incredible messages. Is just me on a higher octave, and I'm just a lesser incarnate version of it, who is responsible, using the alchemical metaphor, the human body is a vessel, and the consciousness is the contents of the vessel. And you have, if you think about four-dimensional space, in three-dimensional space, a vessel can't hold more than its contents. In other words, you know, my cup runs over. You pour water into a glass, and it'll eventually spill over. But in four-dimensional space, the contents can be much larger than the vessel itself. That's a geometrical thing that mathematicians have proven. But anyway, so then there's the whole thing, the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below. Well, if you start to think about it, as above, what's that? Well, that's the huge cosmos, billions of galaxies. All right, that's above. So below, that's the macrocosm is in the microcosm. So in the vessel, in me, is the microcosm, and that is equally infinite. The unconscious psyche is just as big as that universe outside, and we can only perceive a tiny fraction of it, but it is just as big. And to me, that is proof that consciousness itself is a dimensional phenomenon. I talk about this in the Cracking Tower. It's a dimensional phenomenon. We are dimensional beings. Consciousness itself is dimensional, and we can go inside, and we can't probably explore much more than we can on the outside. I mean, you know, we've gone to the moon, but that's about as far. well, we can go to our own inner moon, but there's so much more in there. And you wanted to talk about Gnosticism and stuff like that. Yeah,
well,
there are these entities.
Well, Jim, you know, before we get into that, we got to take a break here.
Okay.
So we'll just be right back, and we'll dive right back in. So
okay,
you're listening
right.
to Expanding
okay,
Mind with Eric Davis and Maja. We're talking to Jim DeCorn, and we'll be right back after these announcements.
Back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau, and we're here with Eric Davis talking with Jim DeCorn about all kinds of crazy consciousness experiences. And I really liked what you were saying before the break, Jim, about the idea that everything is in the one, everything is in the vessel. And this is a very important concept for people to understand about reality, and I think even in science, they're just starting to understand this with things like, you know, zero-point energy or dark matter, you know, which to me, dark matter is a perfect example of the prima materia. But it's how, like, one thing can have everything, like how one of your cells can have the DNA for all the cells, and it's all in a single spot, like... I remember I kind of made a breakthrough with that learning chaos math. Like you said, mathematicians have shown this too, how you can have like a fractal and it'll have a shape, like maybe a star. But then inside the star, the fractal, the thing repeats and it does it for infinity. So how can you have like infinity contained in like a drawing of a geometric shape of a star? It's the same thing with our bodies, and it's the same thing with every part of our body and every atom in our body. And I always think of that Powers of Ten movie by Charles and Ray Eames where, you know, they go all the way out to the epic cosmos and outer space, and then they kind of zoom back in into this couple on a picnic blanket, and then they zoom into the guy's hand, and it's the same thing as it was in outer space. And I think that if more people could somehow have that experience open, like how you're saying, like, you know, I think psychedelics are one way for people to feel this, to realize it. Obviously, alchemy and dreams are another way to kind of get the zoom out, zoom in. I mean, but how can we kind of promulgate this kind of thing? Do you think it's just like encouraging people to get into their dreams, or like how can we like kind of break it out and get everybody on board?
Well, yeah, I don't know. You know, it's all I can do is write about what my experiences have been, and you know, it's not like I get. You know, I don't know. I don't see it in terms of how we can do something to change something else. I think that the best way that we can change the world is to change our own psyches and just be, you know, be who we are, and that alone is changing the world. Okay?
That's so good.
Yeah, because, you know, there's all this talk about now, oh, wow, everything's falling apart on the outside, and what are we going to do, you know, and what can we do about this, and what can we do about, well, you know, really, you know, is it going to be the end of the world? Well, you know, who knows, but... we can't do anything about saving the planet. It's these forces are already in motion. It's like the Sorcerer's Apprentice set this thing a go, set this thing going back at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and now it's really getting out of hand. There isn't anything I don't think that we as egos embodied, you know, on planet Earth can do much about it other than work on our own consciousness. And whether or not it's going to be the end of the world is really unimportant, because what is really true is that every one of us is going to die someday. To that extent, the world will end for each one of us eventually. Whether the external world will, who knows? But we do know that the one, as physical bodies, we're going to die. And if we work on our consciousness and get to the point where we realize that, you know, death and birth are just two sides of the same coin, they just flip over and over and over and over again, I can tell you this, you can't die. You can't. We're eternal, all right, because we are a part of a huge consciousness that goes on forever. And, you know, we'll experience various points of view along the way, but the whole idea is ultimately to work our way back to that oneness, that samadhi experience, where you can call it the mind of God or whatever you want. Actually, one of the things that I found that if somebody wants to really understand this, of the perennial philosophy, Neoplatonism is really a wonderful place to start, because it talks about the one and the many, and how the one is really the only, the highest reality is the one. And as Yogacara Buddhism and Vedanta, the Hindu Vedanta says, is that consciousness itself is the only reality, and everything else is kind of Maya. It's an illusion. It's something
Jim, let me ask you, I'm curious about how, I mean, you talk about the image of the cracking tower, and I think one of the things I liked about the book is that the sort of stark way you make the case that there's really not very much we can do as egos, that we should accept this and then embrace the opportunity to transform, to, become more intimate with the self. But I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about how you see our current kind of environment from the perspective of this kind of Gnostic alchemical view. I mean, in particular, I'm really interested in the way that you think about the archons, this Gnostic idea of the archons, the rulers who are kind of controlling our world, and they're, in some Gnostic accounts, they're very malevolent, in some other ones, they're just kind of lower beings. They can be mischievous, they can be cruel, but they clearly have some place in your kind of vision, your cosmology, your sense of how the cosmos is put together, and that they do have something to do with, like, what the situation that we're in, either psychologically or in terms of the state of the planet. So tell me a little bit about how you think about this very curious category of the archons.
Okay. Archon is Greek for ruler, all right? It's to that extent, I regard it as it's a neutral phrase. There can be good rulers and there can be bad rulers. You can have tyrants and you can have, you know, benevolent rulers. So if we hold on to that idea of ruler, and of course the Gnostics projected this into the cosmos, and basically they're talking about the unconscious psyche. In the unconscious psyche, we have rulers. We're ruled all of the time. We're ruled by all of our unconscious complexes, you know. Say you have a mother complex, and you're going to be so protective of your kids that you warp their growth. You know, you're being gripped by this thing rules your life. I personally have a terrible complex that rules my life. It's called I call him Penny Pincher. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, that costs $13. I can drive 5 miles across town and get the same thing for $12.99. You know, it's totally irrational, and yet it has ruled my life for years and years and years. It's like trying to save money. You know, I'll spend a dollar to save a nickel. That kind of a thing. That's a complex. And if you look into your psyche, you'll realize that you have, it's also called a subpersonality, you know. When you're with your parents, you're in one subpersonality. When you're with your lover, you're in another subpersonality. When, with your boss, it's another. You know, and we alternate between these complexes all day long. And it's the ego. Jung called the ego a complex. The ego is a complex also. And it's a complex of the self. The self is the center of the psyche. And the ego's role is the executive function in the body, is to help the self to integrate all of these other voices in here, to bring them all together so that we can all go back to the one. In the Neoplatonic sense, we can all finally reunite back with the self, which is the one reality. And so the archons, to me, they're like, well, who's the archon who rules Rush Limbaugh. Okay, you know, who's the archon who rules Mitt Romney or Barack Obama or any of these people? These people are ruled by their complexes. They think they are this, but if you look inside, you'll see that they're being ruled by most of the time irrational forces that speak through them. The Gnostics saw these as like demons or angels. The Hindus say the devas and the asuras. And these are the ones who rule our lives. And, yeah, they're rulers. You bet they are. And to take back control is the same as, you know, well, yeah, I can take acid every day, but I'm allowing those, what comes up, to run my life. If I take back control, then I take responsibility for, you know, what these voices tell me. And, you know, and I try to alter their behavior as much as possible, and complexes are very
well. And that's
difficult.
That's what Jung said, right? It's the demons you don't talk to that make you sick.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, you can. There's a thing called active. You asked, you know, earlier about, you know, different techniques you can use. Well, one of them is dream work is one. Active imagination is another, and that's just like you go into a state in which you have conversations with these entities. You have conversations with your rulers, with your complexes, with your archons, and you know, often you will find, you know, they'll talk back to you, and you can actually have conversations with them just like you can with real people, you know, in the outside world, and you can come to a point of agreement, you know, where you say, well, all right, you know, if you promise not to make me drive across town to save a penny, I'll do this or that, you know, and it's this trade-off. And you can start doing that, and that's sort of fairly advanced work, but, you know, you can reach that point eventually. Another thing I wanted to talk about, because you asked earlier about techniques, I found that the Book of Changes, the I Ching, is an absolutely amazing tool.
It's my
and
favorite.
I have used
I do it, like,
for
every
years
day.
And years. I've used it for years and years, and you can become addicted to it, and I finally had to break the addiction. I still use it occasionally, but one thing that I've done is over the years I kept a running notebook of all of my I Ching consultations, and I pulled together a kind of a workbook that I put online. It's on my website, and I call it the Gnostic Book of Changes. And people might find it useful. Basically, it's I've brought in some of my own interpretations of what some of these lines in the I Ching may mean, because they're fairly difficult to understand unless you're really into symbolism.
Well, and symbolism and experience. Like, I do professional I Ching readings, and I'll have to take a look at your workbook, because I record all the answers in this notebook, you know? So I have, like, this mega notebook of everybody's questions that come in, and you can, if you statistically analyze, like, which lines come up for which experience, there's a pattern.
Yep.
Totally.
That's
it's
true.
Crazy.
Well, listen, my daughter is right now putting this on my website. I don't think she's got all of the hexagrams yet, but if you do this with the I Ching, I would love for you to check it out. And I put it on the website, and I invite other people to add to it.
That's great.
It's not like the I Ching is what? It's got to be the oldest book in continuous publication in the history of the world. It's maybe even the world's oldest book. You know, and it's still in publication, and there's an infinite number of translations. But it's also an evolving
book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a living document. And
you know,
so
it's totally alive. Yeah.
It's got these different layers. It's got these earlier oracle bones that then get layered with Han era, Confucianism, and then there's later sort of redactions, and then people figure out patterns that are embedded in it, and it just kind of keeps evolving into the contemporary, you know, moment, which, you know, you're participating in by drawing links between all the different translations.
Yeah.
You know, people get into it, it's like, obviously you need a whole bunch of translations, so you start to learn to, like, see patterns through all of these other kinds of these other kinds of lenses. So I just want to let people know that your website is James D. Korn with a K and an E at the end, .com. Be easy to find it. I was just poking around online, and it looks really fun with the I Ching stuff here. But we're winding up. We got less than 10 minutes here, and I wanted to give you a little opportunity as well, just because the title of the Cracking Tower includes a strategy for transcending 2012, and since the phrase 2012 was there, I felt it was my duty to allow you to riff on that a little bit, in particular because, you know, you're writing some of your ideas, and you also kind of address him directly in your books, you know, reminds of Terence McKenna. And so I just want to give you an opportunity to kind of riff a little bit on that 2012 thing, and in that way McKenna's sort of vexed legacy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, some people have thought that I was critical of Terence in The Cracking Tower, and all I did was point out some things that I thought, you know, were different than my take on it. But I have to, you know, wanted to say that I have utterly respect this man. He changed my life. I mean, I took a seminar with him in 1990, and he was what got me back into, looking at psychedelic plants and stuff like that. But one of the things, because we don't have much time, McKenna talks about, he did a thing called Time Wave Zero, which is a computer program, which was he received from an entity that he met on magic mushrooms, and you know, he was enabled to create a program, a computer program, and related to the mathematics of the I Ching. Okay, well, when I heard that, I thought, oh wow, the I Ching, that's my thing. I really want to know this. And so basically what he calls this program Time Wave Zero, and what Time Wave Zero does is it points to an end point in history, which happens to be December 21st, 2012. Okay, now he was writing about this back in 1990, all right, and he said that one of the things about this prophesied end time was you'll know when it starts, because he calls an effect that he calls the ingression of novelty into time. That means each day becomes exponentially weirder than the day before. All right. Well, back in 1990, things were weird enough, but it hadn't gotten totally exponential yet. But now all you gotta do is look what's going on in the world, and it's like, now that's one prophecy that was smack on. McKenna was absolutely right on it, and I've been following it for years, and it's like, this guy saw it. He saw it coming, and it's happening exactly as predicted. Now, does it mean the end of the world? Who knows what it means? We don't know.
And well, you know, I always like to remind people the etymology of the word weird. The word weird actually comes from Norse, and it was said to describe the runes in a divination system. And the word weird actually means a synchronicity. Like when someone says, oh, that's weird, it's weird because you were thinking the same thing and then it happened. That's why it's weird.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, that's absolutely right on.
Yeah.
So anyway, so basically... And then of course, what's interesting about this, and this is really weird. Okay, McKenna found out he wrote this program and he came up with this idea, and he got it all written down and out, and suddenly he finds out after he's already done this work and come to these conclusions that Jose Arguelles came up with the Mayan prophecy, which was within a couple of days of the same date that McKenna came up with. I think that the December 21st, 2012 thing was the Mayan calendar, and McKenna's came out with his computer program came out with December 19th or something like that. But it was, you know, it was very close. It was close enough so that it counts as a hit. And now when you have two synchronicities coming into conjunction like that, McKenna gets it from the I Ching, Arguelles gets it from the Mayan calendar, and let's not forget that all of the Mayans were really into psychedelic mushrooms, and that McKenna's inner voice came from psychedelic mushrooms, so you could almost say that they came from the same source, if you wanted to look at it that way. That's pretty significant stuff. And all I have to say is, you don't have to take acid, you don't have to be a prophet or a mystic. All you have to do is look at what's happening in the world, and it doesn't take a genius to see that something big's on its way. I mean, ecologically, the world's falling apart. You know, pollution, and we're running out of petroleum, and we're going to bomb Iran. Hey, let's do that. Hey, that's one of the most volatile places in the world.
I have one question here. So, like, you know, when people start thinking about all this stuff, you know, obviously one of the first reactions they have is fear. Just this kind of terror and like, oh my God, where's the ground? Where? How can I want to go back home and all the, you know. How can that kind of energy, that kind of reaction become part of, you know, embracing the situation that we're in and moving forward through it with awakeness?
I have the perfect answer to that. Meher Baba back in the 60s or whenever had this little phrase that he said, don't worry, be happy. Now, that sounds so simplistic, but if you meditate on it, if you're doing the work and you meditate on it, he's absolutely right. You can't die, okay?
Well, and the important thing I always like to remember, it goes back to the entropy together. There cannot be Solve without Coagula.
That's
so
right.
In all points of entropy where everything will break apart, there will be a comeback together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So don't worry. Be happy. It's okay. You know, and next lifetime, we'll take it up where we left off this time, you know, and we may wind up in some other reality. You know, I'm sure that Terrence is off experiencing realities that we can't even imagine right now. You know, he died in 2000, and I often wonder where he is now, you know. But we're all going to wind up someplace, and actually, at the end, we're all going to wind up in the same place.
All right, Jim. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. Again, jamesdecorn.com is the website. The Cracking Tower and Psychedelic Shamanism are the books. Thanks a lot for being on the show.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jim.
All right, from me and Maja, keep your minds open.